Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the 186th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You can get your daily reading from me and other writers on SoccerNewsDay.com. Ladies and gentlemen, chat room is open. Come on in. If you want to talk amongst yourselves, it's all right. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer to the best of my ability. And as we count the days that are remaining, as today is March 31st, a Monday here on the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show, in about 2 days or 1 day, depending on how you count your days, we do it again with Mexico in a friendly over at Glendale, Arizona, the University Stadium, home of the NFL's Arizona Cardinals, as we get ready for the big El Clasico, the big rivalry, the battle of the border south of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California. 'Cause here we go again, and once again, it sounds like spots are available for this roster for the United States for that World Cup that's coming this June from the 12th all the way till July 13th down in Brazil. So let's go. Let's get this thing started. Let's have some fun. Let's have a lot of fun. Let's have a lot of fun, and let's go for it, guys, because it's going to be great. I know I can't wait. But let's not forget, you can listen to that post-game show late night, Wednesday evening, early Thursday morning, right here on the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. It's going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. I'll have with me Kartik Krishnayer, and I believe we'll also have John Jagu covering both sides of this fantastic rivalry. And once again, it's a rivalry, whether you like it or not. The roster already was out a while ago, but there is a bit of a problem right now. And that problem is there is no DeMarcus Beasley and no Michael Orozco Fiscal. Yes, they are not going to be in this game, not due to an injury, due to the fact that, and this is a legitimate gripe, whether you like it or not, it's legitimate, this does not fall on the international calendar. This date of this game does not fall on any FIFA sanctioning whatsoever. Puebla has decided not to allow DeMarcus Beasley and Michael Orozco to play or be a part of the friendly. It's not their doing. They did not refuse the call-up. Puebla has decided not to allow these two to be on the roster for the friendly. Look, it's politics. In football, there's politics. Soccer, there's politics. And you know what? I bet there's been times when an MLS club has had a player from either Mexico or one of the Central American countries and a big match was coming up and they probably refused the respective national team to use those players. So does that mean that DeMarcus Beasley and Michael Orozco is going to get hurt because of this? They probably might. But I think Jurgen Klinsmann, I think he knows what his roster is going to be. And personally, and this is my own opinion, I'm not saying that I have information to pass along because I don't. But what I'm saying is I think DeMarcus Beasley has made the roster. Once again, that's just my opinion. We'll have to wait once the official announcement comes. But in my personal opinion, I believe the roster will have DeMarcus Beasley on it because he's done so much already. He's done so much already to basically get back on his feet and to make this roster for Brazil. Here is the quote from head coach of the U.S. men's national team, and Jürgen Klinsmann. He says, "We're very disappointed in the decision by Puebla. When the match was scheduled, it was with the spirit that both teams would have access to their domestic-based players for what is a very important game for those competing for spots in the World Cup. Both MLS and most clubs in Liga MX honored that idea. While we understand their position, it's a huge opportunity lost for DeMarcus and Michael and doesn't contribute to the continuation of this respected rivalry." You know, this rivalry is big in this confederation. USA versus Mexico is huge. And at the same time that Mexico has some big rivalries with some of the Central American teams, like in Costa Rica, of course, probably as well Honduras, El Salvador, and many other countries that are in the central zone of CONCACAF in the UNCAF region. But once again, it's not on a FIFA date. Am I that upset about it? To be honest with you, I'm not. Because Puebla has the right to say no. Is it good that they said no? In my opinion, it does not. It would be nice and it would be fantastic to see DeMarcus Beasley and Michael Orozco-Fiscal to be on this roster, to be in Arizona, to play in this game. But sadly, Puebla has that right to refuse it, and they have. It's a shame that they have. I wish they didn't have to. But to be honest, it happens. That's how it is. If FIFA would have made a date to make this into an official friendly date, then they should have done so. But, you know, you can't press on FIFA when you make these dates that does not fall on a legitimate calendar date with the House of Football. So, with that being said, I understand there's a player that's been brought over. Tony Beltran, I think, has been brought into the roster. And once again, here is the roster right now. Goalkeepers, you got Bill Hamid, Sean Johnson, Nick Raimondo. I expect Nick Raimondo to start. Now down to seven defenders. Matt Beisler, Brad Evans, Omar Gonzalez, Clarence Goodson, and six defenders. Michael Parkhurst, probably seven now. I think Brad Evans is injured from Seattle. That's why Tony Beltran coming in. And let's also not forget DeAndre Yedlin will be also on the roster here. So that's pretty good. Midfielders are Kyle Beckerman, Michael Bradley, Brad Davis, Landon Donovan, Maurice Edgeu, Luis Gil, Graham Zuzi. And the forwards are Clint Dempsey, Julian Green, Eddie Johnson, and Chris Wondolowski. Now, we talked about Julian Green last week and that situation, of course, mirroring the whole Giuseppe Rossi situation. Now, here's the thing. Julian Green, a forward at Bayern Munich, many people are wondering about this. Is he going to get one of those precious World Cup spots for this World Cup? Because, to be honest, no one knew what he was doing and where he wanted to apply his national team career. Obviously, Aaron Johansson from AZ Alkmaar, the Icelandic American, has, you know, said he'll play for the USA. He's done some things here and there. The big questions are, of course, Jozy Altidore. How will he be on the roster for the World Cup? Will he be on the roster for the World Cup? Because let's be honest, Jozy has done some fantastic things when he was in the Netherlands playing for AZ Alkmaar. But now he's at Sunderland in the Premier League. Will we see Jozy Altidore not be on that final roster? That is the biggest question of all. That is the $50 million question. Could be even a billion-dollar question. Because he's done a lot. That transfer to Sunderland, to be fair, has not helped him. It hasn't helped how he's played, but at the same time, it doesn't help that he's playing on a team that doesn't look that great either in the Premier League. They're on their way to relegation, I would have to assume, unless they find a way to save their own rear ends at the end of the Premier League season. So we're going to have to wait and see what Jozy's going to do, because I'll say this right now. If Green does make the roster for the World Cup this summer, and Jozy is the one that gets excluded, I'm not saying it's going to happen because we don't know what Jurgen Klinsmann is going to do yet. But if that is the case, and we have to be prepared for this, will it be a positive or a negative? That is the one thing we have to worry about. That is the one thing right now with the forwards being picked for this roster for Brazil. That will be the big worry right there. Jozy Altidore's spot in question. Now, like I said, I don't know what's in Klinsmann's head. I can only talk about what I'm seeing that's going on for our guys abroad in England, in Europe, in any league that's going to have American attackers. Is Altidore doing too much? Is he doing too little? I'll be honest. I think he's working hard. I truly believe he's working hard. It's just Sunderland is just probably a bad team. I don't fault him for the contract that he was offered by Paulo Di Canio, who was the manager there at the time. Because, let's be honest, I would have loved to see him get a second shot at the Premier League. Hull didn't do much for him. And it looks like Sunderland is in that direction as well. So we're going to have to wait and see what's going to happen. Would it have been smart for Jozy Altidore to remain in the Eredivisie in the Netherlands? Probably so. I have to believe, I really do have to believe, that Jozy will get it after a year. Because let's be honest, he needs more than 1 year if he is going to be a terror in the Premier League in England. It has to be. It just has to be. And if he gets to get the comfort level he needs, then I think Jozy Altidore will be fine. Remember, he had a very brief stint at Hull. He finally has a full season under his belt in the Premier League. I really believe that he needs another year in England. If they do get relegated to the Championship League, fine. I think that's even better for him. Stay there. Don't quit. Go out there and give it all you got. But right now, that I think right now his spot's in jeopardy. But we will wait and see until the official roster comes out by Jurgen Klinsmann, and we will see what will happen with Jozy Altidore. And I really believe that he could be the one that could be in jeopardy. But if not, great, fantastic. He's on the roster for Brazil, and maybe he just needs to come back and be himself out there. Ladies and gentlemen, I got a very good show for you tonight. Brian Kaiser will be joining us at 8:45 Eastern, 5:45 Pacific, to talk about Harrisburg's brand-new stadium design as they finally will upgrade Skyline Sports Complex. We will have, in the Red Bull Hour, the discussion of the 1-1 draw against Chivas USA at home. But before we talk about that, just awaiting our guest, our special guest, a Mr., as you know him, he has coached the under-20s for the U.S. soccer program. He's coached several MLS teams. When the league was founded in 1996, and he had a great time, and, you know, it's just amazing what he's done to a little island, a territory of the United States in the South Pacific with the American Samoans, and a great big documentary, of course. I'm very happy and pleased to have Mr. Thomas Rongen on with me tonight. Thomas, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and honor to be on this show, Daniel. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for coming on. And I have to say, you know, so many people, obviously, they'll talk about what goes on in Europe, in South America, how qualifying for the World Cup, it's always on everyone's lips. It doesn't matter when it is or what year it is. They always want to get to the World Cup. And you took a chance going to the South Pacific for American Samoa. How was that experience for you? Obviously, it probably was your biggest challenge as a head coach.
I mean, it was first and foremost an incredible experience, you know, an experience of true courage, hope and redemption for that team, a true story of perseverance and adversity. Initially, what attracted me to this island was, you know, it seemed very obvious that the players on that team that had never won anything but continued to play, you know, in the face of defeat time and time again, must really love the sport. So for me, it was A, to rekindle my true love for the sport, B, to be somewhat adventurous, and C, to immerse myself in a new culture, so to speak, and that's what I did, and I immersed myself in their culture, basically threw out all my books and developed like a whole new approach and a new training plan in order for this team to eventually make real sporting history by, you know, beating in World Cup qualifying and finally getting their first goal and their first win against Tonga. So overall, it was just an incredible journey from start to finish.
Now, obviously, you're in the Oceania Football Confederation. At the time, the two powerhouses, of course, still is New Zealand. That's remained in the Confederation. Australia was once in Oceania. Now they're in Asia for the last couple of years or so. But what's it like to be in this qualifying tournament against all these islands? There, some are decent, some that are not so great, but still, it must be a different feeling, or is the football the same?
Well, no, it is a different feeling. I mean, I'd said, and that was a true statement, if you go to a level of a FIFA World Cup qualifying, you expect a standard of play that's up with what you're accustomed to. And when I first got there, and there was a reason why they were last in the rankings in FIFA, obviously, it was one of the poorest teams I'd ever witnessed, regardless of what level and what country. So I knew I had my work cut out. I'd done some research. I felt that within that pre-qualifying phase that we would see some opponents that had a level of similarity in technical, tactical, physical, and mental capability, although previous games had shown that they weren't capable of beating teams that I felt were very similar to American Samoa. And, you know, I felt with hard work, in a short amount of time, you can change organization. You can change the mentality. And those were two important things. We changed the style and system of play. We became a little bit more dogmatic and result-driven. And I had these players, I had the players to buy into this game plan, a scar team that never won, that had lost all of their games, you know, played 41, lost 40, drew one. You know, so this was a team that had tremendous emotional scars, and that was an area where I really made some great strides and made them, prior to our first game against Tonga, believe that they actually could get a result.
You know, I got to say, your keeper, Nicky Salapu, on the trailer, I've watched it many, many times on YouTube, by the way. Fantastic job, and we will talk about the movie production and of your trip to American Samoa. You know, when I see him talking about it, you feel so heartbroken for him because he's faced that horrific destruction that Australia put on that team. You felt so heartbroken for him, like, oh, this guy's got to finally feel good for a win sooner or later. And you just felt really horrible for Nicky and everyone else on that island that they haven't had a chance for a victory at all.
Yeah, I mean, that was a real, real tough decision for me. There were certain fractions within the island that said, don't bring him back. He's based in Seattle. He's older now, obviously, but I really felt that through my research and knowing that he would be the only person that would have gone through that defeat, that 32-0 against Australia. It was one of the most watched YouTube videos ever. And I felt that he could be a real inspiration for this team, especially during periods of doubt and downtime. The only thing you had to do was look at Nicky and look at his face and say, hey, we have to somehow do this for this guy. We got to get a result. We need to make sure that he can keep a clean sheet and shed some of those demons. So he was a very, very integral and important player from the day that he arrived on the island till we left, and he became one of the true leaders of the true inspirational leaders of the team.
Yeah, it looks like it so far. Of course, you know, you're on the island there for these qualifiers. I mean, I'll admit it, you know, I'm guilty because I watched everything through the FIFA websites, through all the qualifying websites, through FIFA, to see how they were doing. And when I scroll down to see your name, I'm like, oh my goodness, this must be something big going on here. If you, like you said before, you know, you did your research and everything. But for those of us that are not there, you know, we rely on the internet these days for these results or what's going on, and you're watching and you're seeing, okay, there's the goal scorer, someone got booked, there's the substitution, and it's just amazing that you had those three matches in that first round in Oceania qualifying for this summer's World Cup. I mean, I can't say anything like how excited I was because you were there.
Yeah, I was, and just to put it all in perspective a little bit, I mean, this team had gone 30 straight defeats in 17 years in official international matches. The 31-0 against Australia, we obviously know, in 2001. 129 goals against, only 2-4. And to finally get that victory so far away and so far removed from real football, so to speak, is truly a measurement of the true spirit of football. And, you know, this team came together in a short amount of time. This team almost got to the final stage, you know, beat Tonga 2-1, tied Solomon Islands, and then barely lost 1-0 against Samoa, one of the islands that went on to face New Zealand and Papua New Guinea and Fiji, some of the stronger teams in Oceania. And as I said again, to be just part of Next Goal Wins, which makes this documentary so special, because nobody knew going into this that we eventually would get a win and would get that first goal, was truly, truly special.
Going back on the YouTube thing, the OFC or the Telegraph from England, they showed a highlight package of American Samoa's first ever victory against Tonga 2-1. You know, just to see you celebrating on the bench, you're just telling the boys, stand behind me, let him come to us, here we go. I enjoy seeing a nation or an island that has never had success finally tasting victory. And that, I know you said it's them, but you can say it. How proud were you of those guys? How proud are you that they went and they fought, even though it was three and out? Well, not really three and out, but you know what I mean. They didn't advance to the next stage, but how proud were you of those guys that they worked so hard? Obviously, there's probably a lot of headbutting going on in the background, but still, they worked hard, not just for themselves, but they worked hard for you.
Yeah, they did. And they refer to the white men in American Samoa in their language as the Palangi. And they've had some previous Palangi come to the island and weren't successful. And the mere fact that I took great pride in finding out about the players, the culture, the way they live, their tribal makeup, and really took a vested interest in the well-being of not just the players but the island, and pushing the soccer envelope as much as possible and creating awareness on the island and creating an atmosphere of family. We had training camp. We slept together. We ate together. We sang together. I think there was a great sense of appreciation, and eventually to get that victory and have the team celebrate and enjoy the fact that they had a coach that cared, and vice versa. I've got a tremendous amount of respect for those players that are true amateurs that play because of the love of the game, still at their ages, something that we in modern football don't see very often anymore. So to me, it was a very rewarding, great spiritual journey, and one that I will remember for a long time, and one that I continue to embrace. I stay in touch with most of the players, and continue to enjoy the fact that they finally got their demons removed, so to speak, and are able to move on in their lives or in their soccer worlds on the island and be somewhat more respected in that part of the world.
Absolutely. Is there a professional league or any form of a league on the island? Is it just one big area? Are there several towns? What do you know about American Samoa that, you know, they can find players to be on this national team?
Well, it's a very small island. You know, it doesn't have a great population. It's got 55,000 people. Pago Pago is the capital. That's also where the training center is, which is a fairly decent facility, I must say. You know, there's a high unemployment rate on the island, about 25%. A lot of young men leave the island to join the U.S. military and to work in American cities.
Mm-hmm.
They only return a few times a year to train and play for the country. So the challenges seem insurmountable. But, you know, from day one we talked about the childhood games, Next Goal Wins, you know, and everybody seems to get motivated and heightened to achieve that goal. And to see that island, that small island, come together, and as I said, there's players from different areas of the island, different tribes of the island, with different religious beliefs, although, you know, the majority of the island, 98%, is Christian, very strong Christian, you know, which means you have to schedule your daily training around around daily church services. Everybody had to sing at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, regardless where they were in the island, sit down, take a moment to reflect and sing the prayer. It was a very very interesting, as I said again, learning experience for me to be there a few weeks and being a part of the world that I've never been to, and being part of something real special that heightened the awareness, and we left a little bit of a legacy, I think, on that island when I left.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now we're going to talk about the movie aspect of it. Was it a pain in the ass to have a camera guy on you 24/7 and having like a mic pack strapped to your ass? I mean, come on. In my opinion, seeing the trailer on YouTube, you know, you handled yourself well. Obviously, people when they do see the movie, I mean, was it a pain in the rear end to have a camera guy on you all the time?
You know what? Not really. We and those guys were unbelievable. You know, to put this whole documentary together. They were respectful. They understood, and this was three Englishmen: Mike Brett and Steve Jamieson, who were the cameramen, and Christian Brody, the producer from Agile Films and Archer's Mark Production. Those guys were pros, and they, you could tell, they've done higher level football movies before and commercials, and have worked with some incredible talent, and they just they were just awesome. You didn't know they were there. There were times where they understood that the cameras didn't have to roll, and although they captured, I think, most of everything as real as possible. And fairly early into the process, nobody really knew that those guys were there. So we were able to work under good circumstances. It didn't interfere with our training regime, our preparation. And I think that everybody had a keen understanding of what these guys were trying to achieve.
That's absolutely fantastic. And I will say this, you butting heads with, which I believe was the president of the American Samoan Football Federation, you know, you told him flat out that he brought you there to change their fortunes. And it sounded like he was almost interfering with what you were trying to do. And obviously you've probably had those moments, you know, when you were a player back in your playing days with coaches, whether it was in the NESL, the original NESL, probably when you were with Ajax back home, and, of course, maybe with general managers here in MLS. That must have been a very tough thing to do when you're talking to the guy who brought you over there.
Yeah, but I also felt there's times when you need to, and this was done in front of the team, that you need to show the team that you care and that you will protect them and that you are there for them. And sometimes that's staged, sometimes you pick your battles, and this was a genuine, hard-fought battle about a practice plan that I had put together that needed to be altered due to certain circumstances that weren't put on paper. So, again, this was real. This was something I felt strong about. We also later, you know, made some amendments and you know, looked at it from both ways and found a compromise that we could work with, because that was the most important thing, creating a healthy working environment in which everybody could be to their best of their ability. You know, I didn't want the player dynamic to change. I wanted to make sure that everything was real and not staged, and that everything was from the heart. I think that was very important the players to understand that I really, really did care about being there and cared about making them better.
No, absolutely. I'm very happy that you showed the players that you cared for them, that you wanted to see them succeed, and that you wanted them to do well in this first round, in these qualifiers in Oceania. And, you know, I have to give you a lot of credit, Thomas, because that was a fantastic display of what you tried to do to get them feeling that they can do everything. And unfortunately, it's always that last match. You got 4 points in the bag. You need at least a draw or probably more to get into that next round. And that last match against Samoa, that I know everyone was proud, but that must have been a bit heart-wrenching or a little gut-wrenching for you that you couldn't get into the next round in Oceania.
Yeah, that was a tough one. But from a realistic standpoint, Samoa was the better team on the day. I think the bigger picture for us was that this would sustain the excitement and a newfound passion for the sport on the island, which it did. You know, the Federation has reported since the win a surge in interest among young players, with more parents enrolling their children into football, soccer. And there's also more awareness that maintaining momentum is the next challenge for this island, and they've done a pretty good job at that. We fell a little short in terms of the performance in the last game on the field, but we gained so much more that's unmeasurable, and as I said again, made that country feel very proud about what they accomplished.
So, where can people view your next goal wins film? Is there like at the? I know the kicking and screening festival is going on April 8th through the 11th. Will everyone in New York see that one, or in the Tribeca area? Where can we see your kicking your next goal win?
Unfortunately, we're not part of that film festival. I would have loved to, but we're part of the Tribeca Film Festival that literally is a week or 2 weeks later, also in Tribeca. It will air on April 19th in New York. That's the opening night. And then it will air and will be in movie theaters throughout the United States, but also will be it has been purchased by 14 other countries around the world: Australia, New Zealand, France, England. England is a big opening in May as well. So right now, you know, we're waiting for the official documentary to premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival on April 19th. So if you're in New York, please stop by.
I know you're with Toronto FC now in their youth academy. If American Samoa asks you to come back for the trip to Russia for 2018, will you take the call?
I would. Well, first, I'm not with Toronto FC anymore, so I just want to make sure that your listeners know that. I'm back in Florida. I'm a free agent, so to speak. So any island that comes calling, and it's tropical and as beautiful as American Samoa, I'll be your coach. I'm doing some work here locally, and I'm trying to parlay this movie into some motivational speaking and then be at some of the screenings to do some Q's and A's. And as I said again, look for the next adventure. The Dutch people travel well, so anybody interested in a coach that can turn around their fortunes, give me a call.
Well, if I know someone, I'll definitely give them the heads up. I want to focus a little bit on American soccer, and you've been around this country for a long time now. Obviously, you've several MLS teams, DC United, New England Revolution, the former Tampa Bay Mutiny. You've played in the original North American Soccer League with the Los Angeles Aztecs, and you've been with the national team with the U.S. for the under-20s in two under-20 tournaments. As someone that's been watching, learning, seeing what is going on with the national team, and of course within Major League Soccer, if I can ask this question, are we going in the right path with how the leagues are going right now and the national team?
I really think so. If you just look, not just at the national team, but if you look at where MLS is at right now after, you know, the inaugural season in 1996 when I was with Tampa Bay, won a championship in 99 with DC United, the amount of strides MLS has made, you look at lower division right now, you look at the NASL, but USL Pro, Los Angeles heavily invested in that as well. More MLS teams will probably go that route. So I think the infrastructure of professional soccer in this country is very, very healthy, and the addition of one or two more teams in the near future is going to help. Miami is obviously, with David Beckham, a key city, and a second team in New York is going to be wonderful as well. And this all has helped you know, our U.S. national team to continue to make strides. Now, are we going to win the World Cup in Brazil? Probably not. Are we going to be competitive? Without a doubt. Have we found some younger players that we can build around with Omar Gonzalez, Matt Beisler, you standout guys like Michael Bradley, Clint Dempsey, Josie Altidore? The influx of the German Americans have helped this team, in particular Jones. And I think if you continue to develop at the rate that the U.S. is doing right now, there's no reason for us not to go to more World Cups in the future and be more competitive and win a World Cup eventually. I firmly believe that there's a lot of talent in this country. It's geographically an incredible large country. I think coaching education is to me still a key component and needs to get better in order for us to do a better job at the grassroots level. But the mere fact that we've got more and more players abroad, and the fact also that we have key players of the U.S. national team coming back to MLS because they feel they can continue to hone their skills in this league, be it Michael Bradley and be it Clint Dempsey, is the two great examples. I think it speaks volumes about where the game has gone since I arrived in this country in 1979 in the old NASL days. There is a clear vision, short and long term. I think with Jurgen Klinsmann, there is a continuation of very positive work being done that was put together really by the Bruce Arenas and the Bob Bradleys of the world that laid a great foundation of teams to go to the World Cup on a pretty regular basis. And, you know, adding a little bit of international flair with Klinsmann, you know, has helped as well. So I think soccer is healthy. I think, you know, you look at the amount of attendance that that the league has. You look at what happens with expansion teams like Seattle, like Portland, like Vancouver, you know, like Toronto. I think that the future of the game with soccer-specific stadiums and a fair amount of very good American players playing in this league and continue to hone their skills and also being able to go overseas, Generation Adidas, component that helps a developmental strategy now to produce more homegrown players is very important too. Most clubs now are very serious about youth development and are investing in the future of their clubs by starting, you know, training younger players. So I think that this country has done a tremendous job in the last two decades to elevate the level of play and making MLS a very viable entity in the sports market.
Thomas, thank you so much for your time. I so much appreciate it. Congratulations with Next Goal Wins. Continued success wherever you go in the U.S. and around the world. And if American Samoa does bring you back, I wish them nothing but success in the next go-around for Russia. Thank you again, and to your future endeavors, good luck.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. Take care.
Take care. Thank you. That's Thomas Rongen, everybody, who took American Samoa nearly into the next round of Oceania World Cup qualifying for Brazil. And let's see what happens as we move on. More success in this country when it comes to stadiums being built for the game. And it doesn't matter where it is, Major League Soccer, the NESL, the USL Pro Leagues, but a place that I call a, okay, a third home, because Orlando's really my second home, but I hope he doesn't. My next guest doesn't take umbrage with that, because it's more Walt Disney World than it is Orlando City SC. Brian
hey,
Kaiser.
I'd love to be in Disney World too, Daniel.
Brian Kaiser, public address announcer for the Harrisburg City Islanders. And finally, a day that finally has come true. There will be a stadium on the site of the northern end of Skyline Sports Complex Island on the Susquehanna River. I'm very happy that its success is finally coming towards the City Islanders and to everyone in Harrisburg that loves the game of soccer.
Yeah, it was a big day last week. Back on March 20th, actually, they announced officially the plans that they are moving forward with the stadium project. It's something that was long time needed, and they were well aware of that. But the owner group did a fabulous job of just pretty much crossing all their T's, dotting all their I's, figuring out exactly what needed to be done in order to undertake something like a new stadium project. And it seems like at least on paper right now, in the planning stages, what they're planning on doing, it's really exciting stuff. Still, the financial aspects of it have to be worked out, but once, and I don't want to make that seem like it's not a big thing. It is a big hurdle at this point, but just going out there and saying we are going to go forward with this stadium project is a huge step for the Harrisburg City Islanders.
You know, the two times I visited the City Islanders, obviously, when you're crossing on the pedestrian bridge and you get to the island, the first thing you see on your right is the minor league baseball stadium for the Harrisburg Senators. And you think to yourself, when you get to the northern end, you hope something like this happens for Harrisburg. It must have been tough, even for yourself. And I know no one hates the baseball team that's affiliated with the Washington Nationals. But still, when that day was going to come for your team that's probably been there a little bit longer than maybe they've been there?
No, they've been there longer than we have, but you know, and they also have been more established. I think one of the things that comes into play here is the difference in how long a team not only has been there, but the actual system of minor league in terms of baseball versus soccer. You've got minor league baseball, which is affiliated with the professional leagues. It is a very distinct way. It's an established way. It's a double-A baseball program, and it's a stadium that befits a double-A baseball program. It's a gorgeous field that the Harrisburg Senators have. They're affiliated with the Washington Nationals, and it's something that is able to be taken care of. You also have a product with baseball with – it's a more frequent gate, so you're going to see teams there more often. You've got a homestand where they're playing every single day for maybe a week or two at a time, and you're bringing that gate in at that point. Whereas for soccer, you might have maybe two, three home games in a month, and there'll be some times where you maybe have five or six, and then there's other months you might just have two. But regardless, it's not as much, it's not that consistent business, and it's also just recently where minor league soccer has really started to affiliate itself and establish that sort of a pecking order where teams are now affiliated, most of the teams in the USL Pro are now affiliated, not all, but most are affiliated with a team from MLS that is using it as sort of a feeder system. So I think the more that happens, the more successful things like this become.
Absolutely. And, of course, for some of you that have never been to the soccer section of the island. It's just, what is it? I think it's four or five small stands on the west side. There's probably two stands together on the north side. That nice little hill with your press box on the east side and that wooden bar area on the south end behind the other goal. I'm trying
You're making it sound a lot nicer than it really is, right? And that's what it is. And where the City Islanders, I mean, everybody associated with the team, the product that has been on the field over the past 10 years has been excellent. And it would be nice to have a facility that befits the excellent product that has been on the field. I mean, if you look at the actual field itself, the field has actually gotten better by leaps and bounds. At one point, it was part baseball, softball diamond in one corner. I remember a game where the City Islanders even lost a game because they lost a ball in a dirt tie-up in the 90th minute and ended up losing a game 2-1 when the goalie misplayed it because of the dirt. So it's been slowly improving, but the one thing that cannot improve is without – real support is that stadium area. The seating area is not up to par. It is an eyesore, and it is one of those things that everyone associated with the team sort of overlooks at this point because they know and have known there's been this hope that something better is coming along. And finally, it seems like that is going to come to fruition. This new stadium plan is a plan for a 4,500-seat facility. It's supposed to be a gorgeous thing, a new entrance plaza, new concession area, new lockers, locker rooms and restroom facilities, a new scoreboard, thank the Lord in my end of things, a new press box and speaker system. So, I mean, you've got an entire facility that does not just have to be a soccer-only facility. They're planning on trying to use it for other things like concerts, but at the beginning, it is going to be the new home for the Harrisburg City Islanders, and they're hoping that in a couple years it will be prepared and ready to go.
Let me ask you this. The opening of Highmark Stadium in Pittsburgh, you know, your rivals in the USL Pro League, did that also play into the minds of the ownership group that you have to build a brand new facility?
I don't think that played in the fact that you have to build one because they did. They knew. This ownership group has been very supportive the entire time. They have been driving the Harrisburg area in terms of the outdoor soccer game. And they've been well aware. The stadium needed to be upgraded, and for the stadium to really draw people in along with the team, you needed to do something, and they've been aware of it. They've been looking for quite some time, and it's just a matter of, you know, time. When you have the opportunity, when is the time right? When is the financial climate right? And they're taking the chance that this is that time where they think they can find the investors and have people jump on board. It's ambitious, but at the same time, it's something where I don't think if they didn't have an idea that they could get the money to put this stadium together, I don't think they would be so brazen as to go out there and say, hey, we're going to put a stadium up. The Pittsburgh situation, I think one of the great things, Daniel, right now about USL Pro, and this is very, very overlooked by most people who don't understand the ins and outs of things. The members of USL Pro are not like a lot of the other minor league groups that I've seen in the past. This is a group of owners where you have spirited rivalries, but at the end of the day, everyone is working together to try to help each other out because they know the success of the other teams in the league makes it more possible for the success of everybody, and that includes your own franchise. The folks out in Pittsburgh have been fabulous in helping out, and owner Eric Pettis of the City Islanders has even said this in interviews. He said, you know, the mistakes that they have made are going to help us because they went out and they were able to put that that stadium out there first. And some of the things that they did wrong, they've been very willing and open in communicating with the City Islanders that, you know, remember this. Don't overlook this aspect of things. And it's something that's really important that while Pittsburgh, it wasn't the spearhead for Harrisburg to put their stadium up. They already had that initiative already in mind before Pittsburgh was even putting anything in the ground. It's something where now with what Pittsburgh has done, they actually have a template to help themselves and maybe improve on some of the things that the Riverhounds were not able to do financially well with their facility.
Very, very true. And, of course, everyone that's associated with Harrisburg, obviously the towns that are just on the other side of the Susquehanna River and nearby, of course, probably big celebrations going on with the youth soccer movement going on, AYSO, U.S. Soccer Youth Movement, everything that Harrisburg has done to be a big melt, not like a melting pot, a big place to gather and support your local team.
It's a good hub right now for professional soccer because the indoor franchise is very popular. Harrisburg Heat is back. You've got the City Islanders for the outdoor game. And both organizations have done a really nice job of reaching out. And both organizations can do more, but both have done a very good job of reaching out to soccer players, young players, working with them with different camps and different foundations that have been put together. In addition, working with the different leagues and having different youth nights and really encouraging them and trying to have their own players get out there and work with these leagues a little bit more. They're doing things the right way, and I think that's the thing that's very satisfying for me being a part of this franchise and being associated with them the way that I am is the fact that I can see that they are doing things the right way on all levels. It's not just a professional soccer team, but it's a team that gives back to the community and gives back to the grassroots of soccer. They've worked with the organizations that are already in place, and they've also done some good work through the J.T. Dorsey Foundation, a former player for the City Islanders who created his own foundation in Harrisburg, where they're working with inner-city kids to really help them learn the game of soccer and learn the important things that soccer can teach a young person, not just on the field, but also off.
When should this stadium be completed for the first season in Harrisburg City Islanders soccer history?
Well, that all depends. what they're looking at right now is I believe they're looking, if I'm not mistaken, the 2016 season is the goal. Which means this year, next year, still in the facility that they currently have. And basically what that gives them is it gives them a couple years to try to raise the capital and be able to finance this thing and put the plans together. They already have a pretty good idea of what they want. It's just a matter of now getting other people on board. And, you know, once they do that, the other nice thing, too, the city of Harrisburg is on board with this. That they understand the importance of really making City Island a focal point and a tourist attraction for people. And with the city really not having a lot of funds themselves, they know that they can't really help, but they can encourage. And the nice thing about the financing of the project, they've already announced, it's not going to be funded by the city of Harrisburg, which will make a lot of people in Harrisburg very happy that their tax dollars aren't going to this, that they're going to get the money from outside sources. So that's the key now, find the money from outside sources. And I think the more and more that word gets out, people understand that, yes, soccer is big. It'd be nice if the U.S. has a nice run in the World Cup later on because then people really get juiced up about soccer even more. But if you have all that stuff come together, it's the opportunity to get this thing going exactly when they want to get this off the ground, and that is that it will be playable for the 2016 season.
Absolutely. I know. I can't wait to see that happen. Brian, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it. Thank you. Congratulations. I know I can't wait when that brand-new stadium gets constructed and ready to go. I can do just to let you know, I can definitely do a before and after. I just have to bring my camera next time.
Trust me, they've got plenty of before pictures right now, and they are not flattering before pictures. So the after is going to be something special.
Yes, it will be. Thanks again. Have a good night, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Daniel.
No problem. It's Brian Kaiser, public address announcer for the Harrisburg City Islanders' new stadium. I don't care what anyone says. I don't care about what needs to happen to make certain things work, to get U.S. soccer involved in their professional club leagues, to go up or down. We all need stadiums. We all need stadiums. And when everyone is in the financial goodness that they will not leave us, then we'll be fine as we move forward in time. We have to be patient. Right now, it's not going to work. But once everything is financially solid and strong, and every single professional club has their own stadiums, they have their own grounds, not paying rent to the people who own the said facility. Only until then, can we implement that mechanism that everyone's begging for. And that's all I've said. I have been on point. And let's hope it will be a lot better than what it has been recently. And now it's time to talk about the New York Red Bulls in the Red Bull Hour here on the 46th Fire American Soccer Show, as the New York Red Bulls, on a late goal by Peggy Luyendula. Yes, Peggy has scored. A late 1-1 draw for the Red Bulls, and in four games, unfortunately, 3 points. They lose a tough one in Vancouver. They get a draw at the home opener against Colorado. They get a draw on the road in Chicago. And they draw again at home against Chivas USA. Everyone's getting anxious. Everyone's getting antsy. And I understand why everyone is feeling like this right now. I understand why. But the truth of the matter is this. We're still early. We're 1 month down and several months to go. There's going to be a lot of interesting things going on. Pecky is not a happy man. He's thankful for the point, but he's not a happy man with how they performed in the first half. They were lackluster. They were not energetic. And unfortunately, Tim Cahill has a right hamstring injury. Granted, he'll be out for this upcoming match on the road in Montreal inside the Stade de Olympique, the Olympic Stadium. But as of right now, we don't know how much more time he'll miss or how much time he could miss if he does not get picked by Australia, which he probably will be, for the World Cup. But definitely it has to be said, and it does have to be said, that was a very poor first half by the New York Red Bulls against a Chivas USA side that, I'll be honest with you, they're not strong, but you got to give them credit for how they have performed at the start of the season. You have to give them credit for being energetic and for attacking the opposition when they put their minds to it. Obviously, second half is different, because I believe in the second half that They allowed the Red Bulls to play their game. But at the same time, the Red Bulls came out roaring. They came out firing, all cylinders, everything going forward for them, everything going strong for them. But the thing is simple. The Red Bulls should have been like this for 90 minutes, not take off for the first 45 and then go for it in the second 45. It should have been 90 from start to finish. That's the truth. And unfortunately, due to injury, we saw Tim Cahill going down. And even when you see him cringing that he can't go on any longer and has to be subbed out, you know it's something serious. Seeing Richard Eckersley going down with the ankle injury, the right ankle sprain, towards first half stoppage time, that's not good either. But to see them get called for another penalty in the area, another penalty in the area, their third time they've been tagged for a penalty against and, of course, converted. This is something that I think is just absolutely atrocious. And sadly, even though he is injured right now, it has to be said, Richard Eckersley, I don't understand why you keep unscrewing your head off your body. I don't understand why you have to put yourself in a position to take down a player in the area and get called for another penalty. Now, I'll say this. The one in Vancouver, and we've said it many, many times, he shouldn't have had his arms up like the way he did because that will allow the officials to say unnatural position. And I'll still continue to say, I don't know where the ball struck him on the left side because the only good angle you have is that the ball hit him on the left. Either it did hit him on the elbow or below the elbow and on his side, because if it was below the elbow and on his side, that's not a penalty. If it did hit him in the elbow, it's a penalty. You do not have a good look at all from the Vancouver television camera angles. But to have Richard Eckersley, and I thought I saw him put a forearm into the back of McNamara. And yes, McNamara, I know, he flung his arms up the way he did. But you don't allow the opposition an opportunity to get a penalty the way that he did. And Richard Eckersley, at the moment, is not looking like a good signing for the Red Bulls to replace Brandon Barklage. In fact, right now, I know most of you are very upset with how Eckersley has been playing. The only good game he had, to be fair, was in the home opener against Colorado. That was the only good game he had. He had a good first half in Chicago, but he started to lose it in the second half in Chicago. So let's be honest here. 2.5 games. Richard Eckersley has been very poor. Very, very poor. And this is the situation that he needs to clean up once he comes back off the injury list with that baseball-sized ankle that sprained on the right side. Eckersley right now is not looking to give confidence to Mike Petke. I know Brandon Barklage right now is in San Jose. The deal has already been done unless there's going to be a trade somewhere down the road. We don't know. Kosuke Kimura took over when Eckersley got subbed out, and Kosuke Kimura was a lot more solid, a lot more steady, comfortable, and he showed plenty of awareness on the defensive side of the ball interacting with Lloyd Sam on the right side of the field, bringing up the ball, and crossing. So even though Richard Eckersley is probably going to be missing a couple of weeks, I don't have the official report on me at the moment, but the truth is this. I'd rather have Kosuke Kimura on the right side of the midfield back line than I would with Richard Eckersley right now, because Eckersley right now has not proven that he deserves to stay in the starting 11 right now. He does not deserve to be in the starting 11, and I'll go on right now to say he doesn't deserve to be on the bench. Right now, I would just scratch him for a couple of games when he returns from the disabled list, because right now he's just showing too much inconsistencies. He's showing too much nerves that he's not listening to what Pecky wants him to do, and he's making silly fouls and silly penalties that are allowing the opposition to take advantage of. Last season, the Red Bulls were whistled for 10 penalties. Three of them were stopped by Luis Robles. I'm sorry, two were stopped, one was missed, but still, that counts as a stop. So as of right now, they are three up and seven to go if they don't get called for another one in Montreal. We're going to have to wait and see what's going to happen when they head up to Montreal this coming Saturday. But the truth is this. Richard Eckersley is looking like a poor signing. He's looking like it's a bad move to bring him over here. We don't know what's going to happen. Maybe it's another pet project for Mike Petke for what he did to Roy Miller, cleaned up his act, got him to calm down, and finally got his head screwed on right. But I'll be honest with you right now. The competition for right back is on. I did watch a little bit of the reserve league game against the Dayton Dutch Lions after the match against Chivas USA. But to be fair, not sure who stood out. I didn't really stay that long. But only Mike Petke knows who wants the position, who wants it more, who is begging for it, who truly wants to be a part of his squad. And that is what he's going to do next. Because right now, if any of these players on the reserve side are going to go out there and they are going to actually fight and steal a starting spot, or at least that secondary right back position from the reserve league, then you know what? They've earned the job. That's right. They have earned the job, in my opinion, because they want it more. They want it that badly. They're hungry. And they probably will not make those silly mistakes that Eckersley has. Outside of that, great corner by Eric Alexander in second half stoppage time. Ula with the header. First goal on a set piece, second goal as a New York Red Bull. The first one last year converted off the spot kick against Montreal and that 4-0 destruction. And all I can say is, for Pecky Uyundula, I'm glad he finally got his opportunity to start as the attacking and creative midfielder. Because right now, he is the only one that can do things there. We'll see what happens this coming Saturday in Montreal. And hopefully everything will go as planned and the Red Bulls can get their first win of the season. Last year, they started with 0 wins, 2 draws, 2 losses in their first 4 games. The only positive is that they have 3 points on 3 draws out of 4 games. If that is the only positive I can give to you, then I apologize wholeheartedly. But that's what it is. And here comes Mike Petke right now. Post-match interview with Mike Petke with the media about that performance by the New York Red Bulls.
Coach Mike Petke. Mike, your general thoughts on the match today?
I'd honestly rather just go to the question, if that's okay.
Great. Take questions, Christian.
Mike, it seemed like there was a difference between first half and second half in terms of defensive shape. Can you just talk about that, some of the compactness it looked like that was brought in the second half, and also Richard Eckersley being taken off? Was that for health reasons or something tactical?
As far as Richard goes, his ankle is like a baseball right now. So, yeah, he was forced out of the game. It was much better in the second half. Overall organization, our desire, our ability to create chances and get forward. But at this point, 4 games in, there's still a lot that we need to clean up, obviously. A lot. And I can't put my finger on it, specifically the first half, but to say that I wasn't happy in the first half would probably be the understatement of the year. So second half was a good response. I thought we saw some very good play, specifically certain players, and to get the goal in the end. But let's put things in perspective. We tied Chivas in the 92nd minute at home. A better Chivas team than last year, for sure. I think they've done well there. But we tied Chivas at home in the 90th minute, so that's not good enough.
It seemed like at the end of the match, when you shook coach's hand, you seemed pretty upset, almost unhappy with the result. So is that why? Because of the way the team, especially in the first half, came out so flat?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you guys have to understand, it's 4 games in. There is no panic button or panic. We were actually 1 game better than we were last year at the start of the first 4 games. However, saying that, I'm trying to not say the wrong thing, if that makes sense, because I'm not happy with a lot of things, and I don't want to make any bold statements. I don't want to do what Mike Petke usually does, comes in and flies off and says things. But I'm going to take a very close look at this reserve game today, to be honest with you. And I'm going to pay very close attention to the reserve players throughout this week, because there has to come a point that some of these kids are given an opportunity that they deserve. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want anybody here to run with that saying that, writing them down, that I'm going to start, I'm going to make wholesale changes next week. That's not what I'm saying. But we need some life in this team at times. And you saw it in the second half, but you saw it very sparingly throughout the first 4 games. And that, to me, talk tactics all you want, talk individual players and mistakes, but at the end of the day, if we're going to come out flat like that, then you might as well not come out at all.
Dave?
Mike, did you have any kind of words with your team, obviously, at halftime to inspire that kind of play? It was just such a stark difference from first to second.
I didn't go in and give him an inspirational speech or anything like that. No, not at all. I'm for sure not going to take credit for them going out second half. I did let them know it wasn't good enough. I did let them know that we need to do things a bit differently, and I pointed out, the things that I thought we needed to do differently. And I think they took it upon themselves and realized, I'm assuming that's what happened, because it was a much different second half.
I'll take Peter and Franco here.
Yeah, Coach, Bobby Conley seemed to play well in the second half in the center. Is that somewhere you might play him more often in the future?
Bobby is definitely one of the players that I could point to, specifically in the second half. And that's the Bobby that I know, that I played with when he was 16 at D.C., that I saw when he played over in England, that I saw bits and pieces when we played them last year. And I think Bobby was very confident today in the second half, and he did very well. But as far as him coming in the middle, I think he read the game a bit, from what I could tell, and he saw that Roy was getting up and down that left side, and he came into the middle to get a numbers up situation, and it worked. And that's why when we brought Eric in, we told Eric to tell him, stay in there with him, you know, and we created those numbers up situations, and he was receiving the ball in good areas and having the confidence to go forward.
Last one here.
Mike, what's the status of Tim Cahill? And also, you said you guys did play well. Who else do you feel had a good game today?
The second half, I thought they all had a great game, to be honest with you. So I don't want to point individuals. I could go down to every one of them and tell them what. I mean, obviously, Lloyd might have been the biggest change from the first to second half. It seemed like that he wasn't in the rhythm the first half. We didn't get him the ball much, but second half, he just tore down the right side. And this week, we were all over our outside guys to go at their outside fullbacks. I mean, you have a guy like Avila, who's a very good player, but he's not a right fullback. They're trying to convert him. And I don't think we did that enough in the first half. I think everybody had a good right mentality in the second half. As far as Tim Cahill, there's another question. I'd probably get in trouble if I made any statements right now without really consulting the doctor, but it looks like at least the best case scenario, a strain in the hamstring, worst case, a pull in the hamstring. But I'm going to go in and meet with the doctors now and figure that out.
That's Mike Pecky about what happened. And, you know, it's really tough seeing Tim Cahill going down like that, obviously. You're hoping it's a strain and it's not a pull. So that's the hope right now. When I get more information, I'll pass along when I can. But, you know, that's a tough way to go, especially when you're going to try and get 3 points on the road in Montreal this coming Saturday afternoon, 4 o'clock Eastern. But obviously, it's going to be really, really tough to see what's going to happen here when the Red Bulls are on the road. Obviously, the turf, once again, in Montreal inside the Olympic Stadium is the same surface as is in New England and Seattle. So probably no Olave, probably no Henri, and it's time to go into the reserves and see what's going to happen. But definitely what you saw in that game, and I understand that they're, you know, Chivas USA, they're fighting every game. They're playing hard. They're doing what they have to do. Give Wilmer Cabrera a lot of credit for getting their side ready to go, ready to play. The one thing, obviously, that many people are arguing about that they've had enough of is the consistency of them falling down. It's not about who they are or where they come from or anything like that. It's just that to see every single play falling down on the ground. And look, I know it's a tough game. There's going to be knocks, and I understand that. But when there's barely anything and people are going down like nothing, you know, it does get tiresome. That's all I'm saying. And so, you know, they're fighting hard. They got a good player, Mauro Rosales, to help them out. Carlos Bocanegra to help them out. Everything is going to be fine. And everything, I think, is going to be doing well for them. And we'll just have to wait and see what's going to happen with Chivas USA. We're just going to have to wait and see what's going to happen with Chivas USA as the season moves forward. I apologize. I'm getting all these great phone calls here in the studio. Probably got to find a way to silence that phone if I can, but hopefully I'll try and get that fixed for you guys. But anyway, so as we keep on talking about what's happening in this game, you know, Luis Robles once again stood on his head when he had to. And, of course, you saw him running all the way across the field for the setting up or trying to set up somebody in the area to get a good shot on. And, boy, oh, boy, he's at the right place at the right time to help out with that equalizer. So Luis Robles, you know, tough game for him because he's giving up another penalty that he's facing. We'll see what happens. Here he is right now, Luis Robles.
What did you see from the from your vantage point when they called the penalty?
I haven't seen the replay, but I mean, it looked like a foul from my standpoint. Looking at the game, starting off with the positives, is we only gave one shot on goal. In the second half, we completely shut them down. Now, granted, they probably changed their lineup so that they were, I think, defending with eight back there. But unfortunately, that shot on goal was a penalty. And three out of four games, we've conceded penalties. And it looks like we're making a run for the record of most conceded penalties in a season. Obviously, it's a tale of two halves. But we're still getting killed by our unforced errors, and that's something that we have to correct if we want to be successful this season.
How surprised were you the way they...
In the second half, well, they let us play. At least to our credit, we came out with a different mindset of just taking the game to them, and then they let us take the game to them. So, I mean, the one thing you could see is the effort level was different. We were winning second balls, which we weren't winning in the first half. And you got to credit Torres. He's a really good striker. He did a good job of holding the ball in the second half. But when he's up there by himself and we have guys swarming him, which, you know, if we would have done in the first half, who knows what happened. But the effort level was the difference.
How surprised were you the way the team came out in the first half at home?
I think I was just as surprised as everyone in the stadium. We were very timid, and they were able to dictate play. They continued to try to expose one side, and the baffling thing about it is we allowed them as a team to continue to do it. But we made that adjustment at halftime, and I think the guys at least did their best to rectify the first half.
Defensively, it looked like a better shape in the second half, a higher line of pressure as well. What did Mike say that needed to be done differently between those two halves?
I think in this case, it wasn't necessarily anything Mike said. It was they allowed us to play. I mean, who knows? It could have been a different half if they came with the mindset of at least playing normal for about 15, 20 minutes. But right from the get-go, you saw that they dropped back pretty deep and they attacked to their forwards, and it was easy to get past that first line. And once you're able to get past that first line, then, I mean, the midfield just had a field day switching balls, playing it through the middle, and unfortunately we just couldn't find that final ball.
It was hard for Marcus to see what happened on the goal. But on Twitter, it was March Madness fever from your end, saying that you got the pick, sweet pick again. Is that how it broke?
I looked at it from my vantage point as a goalkeeper, what would be the most annoying thing that I could do? And that was literally just stand right in front of Dan. And, you know, he allowed me to kind of dictate his position, because he not only came and shoved me, but I think he even followed me a little bit, so it kind of pulled him out of position. So call it what you will. Yeah, I guess you can definitely label it March Madness, but all I know is that I'm 2 for 2 when I go up there.
You don't get an assist on it, so.
I don't care. I'm glad that we got the point. But there's still a lot of things from a team perspective that we need to correct.
Luis Robles on that game, and boy, I gotta tell you, I don't blame him at all. I don't blame him at all for how he feels. You know, there has to be a lot of things going right. You know, when you're watching the preseason and you're seeing how they played against Philadelphia and Jacksonville, okay, decent first half against Sporting Kansas City over at the Disney Soccer Showcase, how they took down Montreal 3-0, winning 1-0 against Fluminense's under-23 side, and it was a shootout, 4-4 against Orlando City, which is the one you didn't see, but you saw the highlights on the Red Bulls website. But still, you know, you're thinking to yourself, they looked good. Everything looked solid. And obviously, you're not going to know until the first game of the season gets underway. But still, you have this feeling that something should have clicked already by now. Something should have just, you know, snapped. Let's go. Here we go. You know, time to get ready. Time to go forward. Time to start playing solid like a team. And so far, things have been very, very slow. But once again, this is the situation that they put themselves in. They got their first win in the fifth game of the season last year. So now the fifth game of the season is coming this Saturday in Montreal, and we'll see what happens. And let's not forget, that'll be that game will be broadcasted on the MSG Network, 4 o'clock Eastern, up in the Olympic Stadium in Montreal. It should be a fun time. I wish the schedule maker would make this trip later in the season. I wish that, to be honest, this game against Montreal would be at Red Bull Arena, and then the road game would be in Stade Saputo, because, look, I understand the rules of in Montreal, in Quebec, in Canada, you know, look, if it's going to be super cold, they can't play outside, they got to play indoors, so let them go inside the Olympic Stadium against someone else, because New York versus Montreal, whether it's in hockey or now in soccer, I think it'd be awesome. Can we just for once have the road game in June, like not so much in June this year, but July or August? That's all I'm saying. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. We'll see what's going on. You know who was man of the match in this game? Lloyd Sam. My God, how he has overtaken the right-winged midfield position and brought that ball down the right side, how he brings it up, gets out of trouble, crosses it into making something so dangerous. He's looking pretty darn good out there. And you know what? He's deserved the starting position. He's deserved it. I mentioned it on Soccer News Day when he was in Jacksonville and, of course, in Orlando. He's proving to Mike Pecky that it's his job. Anyone's going to try to take that job away from him, they got a better chance of outperforming him than assuming they're going to take it. That's why Eric Alexander is on the bench and he's coming off of it, because Lloyd Sam has done the job. And I bet you it's getting frustrating for Lloyd Sam, because right now, he wants 3 points already, and I don't blame him. Here he is right now, Lloyd Sam, on the situation.
First half, I don't even remember much because I hardly touched the ball. It's a bad performance all round from us first half. Second half is more like it, but so we always have to react to something. Like, we need to start the game how we played second half.
What do you attribute that slowness of the first half? Why weren't you guys able to come out with the same kind of urgency you guys had?
Well, I mean, we had a couple injuries in the game. I don't know if people were carrying injuries. I don't know. It looked like a few people weren't playing to their normal ability. So, I mean, second half, after we made the changes, everyone was fresh. Maybe that was the reason.
Was there anything said at halftime from Pecky? I mean, he seemed pretty upset even after the dramatic draw at the end.
I mean, I think we're all upset, because that first half was probably the worst half of football I can remember us playing. It was so bad at home, especially. I've not really seen us be that bad. At halftime, we just had to talk about how we're going to come out the second half, and we just knew that we can't come out how we came out the first half. He said a few words. I can't remember exactly what he said, but he didn't really need to say much. We knew, like, it wasn't good enough.
What was the difference for you in the second half? Was it you just asking for the ball more, getting the ball more, because obviously you started having some more success on that side?
Yeah, I mean, the main difference probably was actually getting the ball. First half, I didn't really get the ball in the opponent's half. If I got it, it was in my half. Everyone seemed a bit more relaxed. Maybe they dropped off us a bit. So just getting the ball, really. And knowing that we're 1-0 down at home, everyone tells up a little bit more.
Do you think the team may have underestimated Chivas going into it a little bit?
I don't think we underestimated Chivas. I mean, when you look at their team, you see they're a better team than last year. And we haven't had 3 points yet, so we can't underestimate anyone. So we came out knowing we got a win. So I wouldn't say we underestimated anyone.
What do you think Pecky brought today?
Obviously,
he got the goal at the end, but besides that, you know, what do you think he brought from the central midfield spot?
Again, first half, no one was able to play, so it was hard to say. But second half, he played well. Bobby Conway played really well. And we need that from Bobby. Like, we need him to play like that. But both, I mean, everyone seems to gel a lot better second half. Let's hope it's like that, a bit more going on.
despite the finish now, you're in basically the same place as last year, no wins in four games.
Yeah.
And with a game in Montreal, probably without Cahill and Henry, so what does that look like?
It's tough. Like, every other away game is tough, so... And I'm not sure what stadium we're in. What stadium we're in? Are we in the same one as last year?
Yeah.
So that's probably going to be an even tougher game. I mean, we're going to go out there and do our best. I mean, every away game, you know what it's like out here. You just got to do the right things on the day.
That's Lloyd Sam talking about his part of the game. And you know what? It's just one of those things where you know, he wasn't getting the ball in the first half. They were probably that much. And unfortunately, it's just one of those things where I feel bad for him. Because if he got the ball a lot in the first half, they probably would have gotten a goal or two early on. But instead, they were down 1-0 in the early on in the first half. And it took them into second half stoppage time to finally get the equalizer. So it was tough. I want to talk about something that happened in the match. And you know what? It really got me thinking here a little bit because, once again, this is something about the laws of the game that really do bother me when it's not interpreted the correct way. Now, there was a goal that was removed for the Red Bulls because apparently it seemed to be Bradley Wright Phillips might have bumped into Dan Kennedy and Kennedy lost the handle and then the ball went into the back of the net. The claim from the referee was that Bradley Wright Phillips bumped into Kennedy. Now, it's really interesting because I finally saw the replay back home. The monitors were not out in the press box because of the rainstorm that came, even though it came late in the game. But, you know, I understand you don't want – we don't want anybody in the press box to, you know, all of a sudden get electrocuted for no reason, you know. But, hey, what are you going to do? But I got home. I DVR'd the game, as I always do, every game, whether I'm home or watching, you know, covering the game at home when they're on the road or DVRing the home games when I'm at Red Bull Arena. And I noticed something because I thought from live, with the game in front of me, I thought the whistle blew because Bradley Wright Phillips bumped the keeper or it was a handball, meaning, the you know, someone accidentally slapped the ball out of Dan Kennedy's hands and it went into the goal. Watching the replays and watching everything that happened, there is a problem with this particular call that I have, and this stems from last season on the road in Chicago. Because, once again, it's about how you interpret a particular law when the keeper has the ball. Now, let's go to what happened to Luis Robles last year in Chicago. Luis Robles is underneath the ball as it was deflected high in the air, and as it was coming down or coming towards him, he was in position to grab the ball and did so. Robles grabbed the ball, had possession in his hands. Before he can haul it in, Daniel Palandini from the Fire is running to get the ball. And what does Palandini do? He heads the ball out of Robles' hands, and that stood as a goal. That stood as a goal. All of a sudden in this game, when the cross came from Lloyd Sam, and Dan Kennedy did grab the ball, and he did have like one or two steps after he grabbed the ball, And then you see him bump into Bradley Wright Phillips. And to be honest, I think that was more of Kennedy bumping into Phillips, into Wright Phillips, than the other way around. The ball popped out of his hands, and it went into the back of the net, rolling into the back of the net. But the referee calls for the whistle to be blown because apparently Bradley Wright Phillips fouls Dan Kennedy when it's really the other way around, that Kennedy bumps into Wright Phillips and lost the handle. So this is a situation where I'm really confused and I'm really annoyed at the same time, because this is a situation where I think it's the keeper's fault, meaning Dan Kennedy, for not truly securing the ball, and he basically bumps into Wright Phillips and he lost the handle. That's where I think that should have been a goal. On the opposite side of it, when it was last season in Chicago, Palandini intentionally headed the ball out of the hands of Robles. To me, that's striking the keeper. The goal should not count. And then it'd still be, at the time, 1-0 Red Bulls into the half. I understand different referees interpret the laws of the game differently. And unfortunately, this is where not just MLS and Pro have to get involved. CONCACAF has to get involved. FIFA has to get involved. Because we cannot have referees interpret the laws of the game in a different way. Because then we get more confusion. We get more arguments. We get more yelling, more blaming the officials, when this should be clear cut. Because we cannot have officials on the field having an agenda against certain clubs, because that is wrong. And you cannot allow an on-field official to be placed in that position to take away a goal, or a goal that should not stand. We have to have everything done the right way. I know what you're saying right now. Bring back the replacements. No. It's not about bringing back the replacements. It's about having your on-field officials learn the laws of the game the way it was meant to be interpreted. I know I probably butchered it. Interpreted. Thank you. We have to have our officials teach them better, train them better, and to make sure that everything is done the correct way from start to finish, every game. Are they human? Yes, they are human. But the sad thing is that there is going to be some refs that puts on that yellow shirt, black shorts, and black socks, and they're going to make these decisions that will affect the game. The idea, once again, is to be less noticeable on the field. Do your job to interpret the laws of the game the proper way. I think that's all we're asking for, to be honest. And that's what has me a bit miffed. You can interpret it one way, it's going to get interpreted another, but once again, I think the terminology coming out is know your referees. Know your referees, because if you know how they're going to call a game, then that's the only way you're going to win a game. And sometimes it feels like these referees who are supposed to interpret the laws of the game are not doing it the right way. Do they need to be fixed? Yes. And I believe that Peter Walton, now back in the swing of things, will be the man to do the job again. I believe he has done a good job so far. I think Mark Geiger, who is probably the top American referee in the pro part of MLS, at the moment is the good one. There have been others that have done well. There are those that have done very terrible. And his name is Baldomero Toledo. But the truth is that pro, I hope, will do the right job, which so far they've had, and will get things going on as the season progresses. But that's just my little problem there with how this game was officiated here and there. I know we can't look back at the season last year, but if we're going to talk about how is it possible that Chicago was allowed to have that goal against the Red Bulls in Toyota Park, the way that Palandini headed the ball out of Robles' hand and into the goal, and then you have this situation against Chivas USA where Kennedy actually bumps into Wright Phillips. Wright Phillips has every right to go for the ball, and he has every right to stand there in the area, and it's not his fault. It's not like he actually leaned into Kennedy. Kennedy went into him, lost the ball, but it was wiped out. So all I can say is there's got to be a way to fix this situation and fix it so we don't have to worry about what's considered a goal and what's not considered a goal. So we'll have to wait and see on that. But at the end of the day, it's a 1-1 draw, unfortunately, at home. Very dramatic, without Tim Cahill on the field. Hopefully it's not going to be too long that he'll be back against DC United on the road next Saturday. And hopefully we'll see some good stuff going on. But obviously, it's very troubling right now, and I understand. All I can say is they are 1 point better in their first four games this season than they were last season. And if they do get their first win in Montreal, it's a four-game unbeaten streak. So right now you're on a four-game losing streak, or a four-game winless streak, I should say. And then you can turn it into a four-game winning streak if you do find a way, or if they do find a way, to get a victory. And if you take a look right now in the Eastern Conference standings, and look, like I said, it's early. You don't really want to do that. You really don't want to go and take a look at the standings right now because it's only been 1 month that has passed. You're trying not to do anything to worry so much about how the East is right now. But if you take a look right now in the Eastern Conference table, the New York Red Bulls are currently in eighth place. The Montreal Impact are in ninth. And once again, DC United is dead last. Dead last. Montreal and DC have only 1 point for themselves. Montreal has 1 point in four games. DC United has 1 point in three games. So right now you're asking yourself, what do the Red Bulls need to do? They need to win to jump up in the Eastern Conference table. Depending on what Philadelphia does at the moment, they have 5 points. We'll find out during the week who their opponents will be, or they'll take a break. But as of right now, you are above Montreal and DC United. Montreal so far has played one game more than DC, and DC at the moment has a point in the 2-2 draw against the Chicago Fire at RFK. This is the point of the season, and once again, it's early. We're already a month into it. 6 points are on the line on the road. Montreal looks very, very beatable. DC United looks very beatable. Have they started to turn it around? We don't know. But the truth is that the Red Bulls need to turn their fortunes around as well. The Red Bulls need to turn things around as quickly as possible so they can grab 6 points in these next two games before they start having a two-game homestand on two consecutive Wednesdays against Philadelphia and then Houston. And now it's time to turn our attention to the big news that happened a couple of days ago. The Arsenal are coming to Red Bull Arena Saturday, July 26th. Thierry Henry's favorite club, the club he loves, the club that he is such in love with because it's where he really got his big break, will be coming to Red Bull Arena. First time in 25 years, I understand, that Arsenal will be here at Red Bull Arena and in the United States. First time in the U.S. in 25 years since a friendly against an Argentine side down in Miami, Florida. You know, I got to say, I'm very interested to see what's going to happen when Arsene Wenger comes over. Of course, Theo Walcott, Mesut Ozil, Olivier Giroud. And who knows? Who knows? But I'll tell you this much right now. I'll tell you this right now. I can't wait to see this. Because, yeah, I know it's a friendly. It's not a real league match. I understand that. But I have to say that I cannot wait to see this happen. I understand what some of you guys are saying. Well, you know, we're sick and tired of these friendlies. We shouldn't have these club friendlies anymore. It's going to be very close to the time when the Red Bulls perform in the CONCACAF Champions League in the group stage in August. But you know what? You have to do these things, you know, because you're going to get a lot of money. You know, the club's going to get a lot of money out of this. And when the club gets the money, everything's going to be fine. But I'm interested to see Arsene Wenger, to be honest with you. You know, this man has been through a lot when it comes to these EPL seasons. He still has an opportunity to try to win the league title, even though it might be a little more impossible. There's not a lot of matches remaining. But let's not forget, there's a semifinal in the FA Cup that he has to play for and to hopefully, you know, get that big championship as the best club in England in that FA Cup. You know, I'm not a hater for Arsenal. I still have my Manchester United jersey, but I really haven't been supporting them. I kind of gave up on them. Not so much that, you know, it's all about Moyes and stuff. No, it's more about Euro snobs, to be honest. Because I had enough of them. There's still some around there, I know. But still, I would love to see Arsenal play. I've seen Barcelona play against the Red Bulls. I've seen Boca Juniors actually playing the Metro Stars in a friendly at the old Giant Stadium. And that was during the 2002 World Cup. I remember when Boca Juniors came to the Giant Stadium to play a friendly against the Metro Stars. And that's when we still had Diallo, I believe. And the stadium wasn't packed, but there was a good amount of Boca Junior fans that came either traveling up from Argentina, from Buenos Aires, or for the Argentinians that are Boca fans that are in Queens and Brooklyn and New York City and New Jersey. And when the Metros were beating them, I think it was 3-2, and that's when they had Rodrigo Faria, I was chanting with some of my fellow ESCers because the USA got out of the group stage, beat Mexico in the second round, and I think Argentina either lost or got eliminated in the group stage or got eliminated in the second round. I don't remember when it was. I'm going to have to quickly look it up here for past World Cups. But I think they got eliminated in the second round. I'm going to have to double check on that. I'm going to take a look right now because apparently everyone in FIFA is busy with Brazil right now, so I can't really go back to that. So I'm going to go to – here we go. Let's see here. See if we get the results here. So I'd love the results. Let's get the results. Argentina. I know they're in the same group with England. Here we go. No, Argentina got eliminated in the group stages. They defeated Nigeria 1-0, lost to England 0-1, and then they drew with Sweden 1-1 because England drew Sweden and drew Nigeria. Sweden was a draw as well. Sweden defeated Nigeria. Nigeria was kind of like the whipping boy in that Group F. So after defeating Mexico 2-0, 2-0 in the second round of the 2002 World Cup, I remember chanting against the Argentines, "We are going to the quarterfinals. We're going to the quarterfinals." That was the chant with about myself and I would say 9 to 10 others back then. That was cool. I love that. That was so cool. Well, I'll tell you, that was a great victory. I know it's a friendly. We're not going to face them in a league game or, you know, FIFA Club World Cup or invited to a Copa Libertadores match, but still it was nice to get a solid friendly victory against one of the top teams, club sides in Argentina. It's been absolutely fantastic. And that was great, 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 great to see that happen. Other than that, just got to get ready for Montreal on the road. And see what they can do to get that first win of the season. I want to thank my guests. First, obviously, I want to thank Brian Kaiser from Harrisburg on the discussion of the new stadium that's going to get built, hopefully, which I believe it will. But I also want to thank Mr. Thomas Rongen, who gave me his time to talk about his trip to the American Samoa Islands and, of course, their World Cup qualifying hopes and dreams in Oceania, talking about Oceania and, of course, talking about the people who created the Next Goal Wins movie that will be at the Tribeca Film Festival and in theaters across the country. Check Yahoo Movies or IMDb for when it will be coming out. My name's Daniel Feuerstein. Don't forget, this coming Wednesday night, early Thursday morning, USA against Mexico, big friendly classic go. As always, enjoy your football and talk to you Wednesday night, early Thursday morning. Have a good night, everybody.